Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Anne Lamott, whose latest book is Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith, a series of essays. Anne Lamott is the author of several books, including Traveling Mercies. Blue Shoe was the last novel. You're working on another novel now?
No, not working on anything. I'm just still sort of ending up a book tour.
Anne Lamott, these essays appeared mostly in Salon?
Mostly. About 80% of them were at Salon, yeah.
How do you like writing for them, writing online rather than in print? Does it matter to you at all?
No, it doesn't make any difference to me. I just totally love Salon. I love the quality of writing there. I love their politics and their investigations. So I write exactly like I write for print, and then I love that it gets published within a few days instead of a couple months later.
Many of these essays do deal with you as a Christian, a religious Christian, trying to deal with George W. Bush. And I know you talk about the fact that you're a leftist Christian. It seems that there are very few of them around the country, but there are a lot of them.
There are a lot of them around the country. It's just that the very right-wing Christians are so much more dramatic in their style, let's say, and in the rhetoric, that they seem to get more attention. But I'm convinced that there are almost as many Democratic Christians as there are Republican.
We're talking about born-agains as opposed to...
Oh, I'm not a born-again, really. I mean, we're talking about believers in Jesus who go to church fairly often. Yeah, I think that it's probably pretty equal.
When I spoke with Marilyn Robinson, who wrote Gilead, she's angry because she says the right-wing cherry-picks what they want and leaves the rest, and that the New Testament is full of material about us supporting the poor, and that's completely ignored by the right-wing.
Well, I think the right wing talks about supporting the poor. It's just that there's also a line in the New Testament that faith without works is dead. And so you just hear this endless talk about all this work that these compassionate conservatives are doing for the poor, but I don't see them putting their money where their mouth is. I've also heard Bush refer to the deserving poor, whatever the hell that means. Jesus certainly doesn't talk about that, but the right has always done this. You used to be able to pick what you wanted from the New Testament to show that supposedly that Jesus supported slavery, that Jesus supported the subjugation of women, the physical abuse of children. So, you know, you can kind of translate it any way you want.
When you were on your book tour, did you run into any right-wing Christians who said you weren't a Christian or anything?
Oh, I always do, but mostly I think by now, this is my 10th book. If you come to one of my readings, you must know where I stand on things, which is that I'm a progressive and a loudmouth. And a few Christians came, and in a couple of cases it was unpleasant because in lines at book signings they would sort of assault scripture me and read scripture always from the Old Testament that they would say prove that Jesus really hated gays and lesbians and only believed in this or that, and it's just such BS. And then a few other Christians, one woman I'm thinking of in particular, a sort of older woman, took my hands and she said, I love your work, but it hurts me to hear you talk about the Christian right this way. It breaks my heart. And I said, well, it breaks my heart to be ruled this way by the Christian right, and it's destroying not only the nation, but the earth. And I have to just stand up for what I believe and try to mobilize people into turning him back.
And what did she say to that?
She just, you know, we held hands for a moment and looked at each other and were very kind and respectful of each other. Another woman from the right in L.A. said something very similar, but she said, the reason I'm here and the reason I love your work is because you speak of where all differences end, and that was very meaningful to me.
Where all differences end?
Yeah, where we're believers in Jesus, where I'm a believer in the God of Dr. Martin Luther King, and she might be a believer in the God that a Christian televangelist talks about, but where the difference ends is that Jesus was just so, so, so passionately in love with us all and looking beyond our faults and seeing our needs and always welcoming us and always having a moment for everyone. So,
are you familiar with the work of a writer, philosopher named George Lakoff?
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, he talks about that when you break down the Republican view and the Democrat view, one view says that government is the stern father, and the other, it's the compassionate parent. And I wonder if that breakdown is kind of a similar breakdown between Old New Testament, between your kind of Christianity and the Christianity of, say, that woman who approached you, because it seems this seems to be a connection there.
Well, it's an old cliche that the Republicans are the daddies and the Democrats are the mommies, and no one respects the mommies. And I think that is something I would say holds up after all this time. But it's such a slur on the mommies, which is to say that those are the values I support, the tenderness and the compassion and the focus on children and on trying to help other mothers who are less fortunate raise their children with dignity. And I just don't think it's so important for, I don't think it's meaningful in terms of the next election in 2006, or certainly not meaningful to my own faith to try to figure out or to position myself in opposition to the Republicans, or to deconstruct all of the ways in which their planks are filled with stuff that, like Marilyn Robinson would say, they cherry-picked for their own ideological slash political slash financial gain.
Anne Lamott, in the essays in this book, Plan B, you're constantly trying to find a way to love or forgive George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
You're still having problems with that.
Terrible. I would say I'm not constantly. I would say from time to time, because Jesus is really very clear. He doesn't say you really have to try to love and forgive everybody. He says you're made of love. You're made in the image of God, which is love. You need to go and be my love. If you're a follower of me, you need to know that what Jesus says is he doesn't have hands or hearts or eyes or feet to do his work among the poor and the suffering and the lost, and that we're the people that need to go out and do that. So all I can say is that for a couple of years I felt just tormented by the administration, and not just, certainly not just from a Christian point of view, just from a Democratic point of view, that watching them just steal away everything that this country is based on of civil liberties and this fragile, precious thing called democracy and equality. And for a couple of years, I had to go up to the altar at the end of the service, where you go up if you're extremely sick or mentally not okay, and I needed to ask the pastor to pray with me, and I haven't had to in the last 4 or 5 months. And I think because even though they won the election, that was devastating. It took me a very, very long time to come back from. I still feel they're going down. And as I said in Plan B, my prayer is that they not destroy the earth on their way down, but they're definitely going down.
Think so.
Oh, definitely. The Tom DeLay's thing is the most obvious and most recent example of that. What's happening to him, and the reports in the Washington Post and the Times that he his trip to Russia was sponsored by private industry, and that got Russian industry, and that his wife and daughter have been paid in the last 2 years $500,000 by his PACs. But this ridiculous, pathetic waste of time of him, Bush, doing 60 cities to talk about Social Security, which would basically steal from the poor and from the obscenely poor and from the very, very, very old to give to Wall Street and to his people on Wall Street is just such a loss for him. And I think it's going to do him great damage. And I think you're seeing a lot of Republicans bail because they have to run again in 2006.
How do you think the Terry Schiavo brouhaha plays out in all this?
Well, I think that it was a catastrophic mistake for Congress to, well, you know, everyone's talking about them reaching too far, but for them to make a new law in the middle of the night on the week of Easter to, with most of the members missing, to try to do this sort of right-to-life thing for a woman whose cerebral cortex, by all reliable accounts, is liquefied. And then for Bush and his infinite op-ed cravings to fly in the middle of the night from Crawford to sign it, I think it's going to hurt them very badly. I mean, you saw the polls. I mean, 75% of Republicans thought that the government should stay out of this private matter. So, and then you've got the real crazies in the right to life who think that the mother's life doesn't count any more than the life of a completely unformed 6-week-old fetus, or who are fighting for the lives of the embryos in these frozen petri dishes that are being thrown out at reproductive clinics. So, I mean, it's so crazy, and I think that the Terry Schiavo congressional efforts really hurt them badly.
I was watching, switching around. I don't watch too much regular TV. I mostly just watch DVDs and film because I can't deal with the crap. But I was switching around, and I stumbled on MSNBC and saw on a daily basis on Chris Matthews' show people from the Family Research Council every day talking about this, and I kept thinking, why are they promoting this horrible group that wants to censor everything we see and hear? It's like the media has fallen into this, the general media.
The media has so failed us. Even CNN, which is not quite as far gone as NBC, is just an abomination and an embarrassment. Not even just the quality of the newscasters, such as Rick Sanchez, who's Darren Kagan's new partner in the morning news, who's actually dating and madly in love with and maybe engaged to Rush Limbaugh, although I hear she's a liberal. Rick Sanchez is like a Saturday Night Live character. He's so inept and pathetic. And the whole thing is like this infomercial. There have been maybe four news stories. There's huge stuff happening. Something like 15 men were killed in the helicopter crash in Afghanistan. And if it's on the news, it's at about 8 minutes of the hour, because all they cover now is the Pope and the lines and lines of Pope and the Pope and the Pope. And no one mentions that the Pope was, you know, total gay basher, and that he and also no one mentions that he was so ferociously opposed to Bush on both Iraq and capital punishment. It's all being absorbed, so it can be this homogenous pap that we're fed now. But that also, besides the gay bashing and that madness, the extreme conservative of his anti-condom state, the condoms aren't allowed in Africa. I mean, the madness and the number of deaths that could have been averted if he had said, we are in a brave, new, terrifying world, and 30 million people are infected with AIDS, and the gravest danger to a woman in Africa of dying of AIDS is marriage, and these women ought to be using condoms. But nope, didn't do it. Just stuck to the very hardcore right-wing conservative Catholic position. So I know he did some great things. I love that he went into the mosque and kissed the Torah. I love that he apologized. But it doesn't do really ultimately all that much good, whereas condoms would.
You know, one thing about staying away from TV mostly, I mean, I would switch around and just see the same garbage. Joan Ryan wrote an excellent essay in The Chronicle talking about those things. And you see it in print, but you don't see it on television.
No, you
don't.
And
that's what people, you know, I keep running across people, oh, I don't read books, I just watch TV. And I'm thinking, well, of course we elected, assuming the U.S. actually did elect Bush, you know. Of course, because people are seeing propaganda. We've entered the Soviet Union, you know, the state of the Soviet Union, only people don't know.
Mm-hmm. People are very, very scared and sad, and that's why Bush was elected this last time. I think he probably did win by a little, but people are just so scared because it's been this cult. Now it's supposed to turn to the culture of life, but which means the frozen embryos that are being thrown out in the reproduction clinics, but and Terri Schiavo with her liquid brain. But before, it was like the culture of terrorizing its own people, which they didn't use that phrase, but people have been terrorized. People are being thrown in jails, both in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, but all over the country without habeas corpus. And it's just, my friend said, it's just Kafka's worst nightmare. And what I keep doing is to try to make sense of it. And she said, just stop.
Well, Anne Lamott, these essays in Plan B are primarily about your life and your family.
Yeah.
Particularly your battles, your loving battles with your son, Sam, and his alter ego, Phil, which just absolutely cracked me up, that the evil adolescent that arises, you gave him another name. I have a nephew who's 14 who visited me last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wish I'd realized that, you know, I kind of separate out Stephen from his Phil.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, it is. I know. Well, there's just actually a couple pieces on Sam in this, but the very favorite piece I ever wrote is in Plan B. It's the one called Diamond Heart, about walking with Sam in the mountains. And you can actually see the incredible sweetness and dearness of who the 15-and-a-half-year-old can be. But then the other arrives. But then I'm also in menopause, so there's me, who's mostly mellow and sort of Birkenstocky and funny most of the time and easygoing, and then there's the other, you know, the death crone of sensitivity and otherness and oddness. So there are a couple pieces about Sam, and there are a couple pieces about the difficulties of trying to make peace with my mother even after her death. And there's a piece that everybody relates to, which is about the death of our dog, because I really believe that the closest you're ever going to get to seeing the direct face of God on this earth is in the face of a dog you really love. Sometimes you can see God's face in just the response to catastrophe. I mean, you can feel it more than anything, but you can see God's unconditional love and loyalty in the face of good dogs. I wrote a piece about that, and you know, I wrote all the pieces that I would like to come upon. I try to help people keep their senses of humor about teenagers and impossible parents and themselves and their bodies, and also about George Bush and so on. It's a pretty eclectic group of essays, I think.
How many essays did you have total that you whittled down to this number?
Probably had it close to 50.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wrote three that are a little longer that were specifically written original for the book.
When you're doing that, what are the criteria that you're using to determine what will go in a book?
Well, let's see. That's a good question. Well, first of all, as with most creativity, like 70% is taking stuff out. So it's really easy to take a bunch of stuff out that I don't really think would stand the test of time. That's either too specific or about a specific issue or cause or that I just don't love anymore. And then, so maybe there were 30, 35 pieces that I liked a lot. And then it was easy to take out another, you know, 6 or 7 or 8. And then getting down to 24 pieces, I'll tell you the first rejection letter I ever got said from Gordon Lish, who used to be a hugely important voice in fiction 30 years ago, said, "You've made the mistake of thinking that everything that happens to you is interesting." And so I look at some of my work through those eyes and I think that I was trying too hard. I was trying too hard to be funny or charming or whatever. And so I take that stuff out, and then I'm left with 24 pieces or so, and they're not nearly in good enough shape to publish. I mean, I have a great editor at Salon, Lori Leibowitz, who does a wonderful job with me every 2 weeks on getting these things into good shape. But those are in shape to be online, which is to say for 2 days. Probably, and what I'm trying to do is create works of art that can be arranged to be a whole, to be one whole, instead of just like beads on a necklace, or at least I need to find the necklace cord to string them on. And so at the point where I have the 20, I think I had 22, and each one of them took about a week to really, really bear down on and bring up, burnish and bring up to the highest quality I could. And then there were a couple pieces that I felt shy about, but that I thought were important. For instance, one is about why I made Sam go to church till he was 15. And I didn't mention in the book, because he hadn't turned 15 at the time, I guess, that at 15 I released him to his own pursuits spiritually, into his own authentic spiritual wanderings. But I had gotten a lot of flack for that at Salon, and yet I thought it was a very important piece, and I still believe that there are worse things a parent can do than to listen deeply to their own heart and try to figure out how morally and ethically and spiritually they want to raise their children. So I kind of showed that to my editor as an aftermath and thought she would say, "Oh, it's just too provocative," because most of my readers are probably Democrats and a lot of them are probably secular. She said, "I love this. It's a very important piece." So we put that in. And then there was a commencement address I'd given at Berkeley, and I thought, "Oh, that's so self-referential to include an address you gave." But it's called "Let Us Commence," and
that's the second to last essay.
Yeah, it's the second to last essay, and then the book ends at the Peace March on Market Street, and it worked so organically there. It to be saying to however many, like, you know, 5,000 students, "This is everything I know about your souls and your spirit, and as you go out from here, I know a whole bunch of stuff that really won't fill up the holes inside of you, and I know a whole bunch of stuff that will. I know that service will. I know that getting very, very quiet more often will. I know that turning most of the things that make noise in your house off will. I know intimacy will. I know," and then for the next piece to be, "Here are we going out into the street to put feet to our conviction that this war was wrong, that peace is the way of Jesus, that peace is the way of the saints, that when we come together, when brothers and sisters come together into these tribal expressions of, that happen to also be an incredibly hilarious experience, especially on Market Street, then we get our buoyancy back." And so I thought that those two pieces kind of led the reader out of the book in a sort of graceful, funny way.
Anne Lamott, there's a couple of essays, the essays on your mother, then an essay about a friend named Anne who died, mm-hmm. who was an activist who wanted you to pray at KPFA,
yeah.
which was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And another, Sue. I had a friend who passed away from breast cancer complications last year.
Mm-hmm.
As a secular person, it's very difficult for me to deal with it. Do you find it, as someone who's religious, easier, or is it just a different kind of pain?
I think it's the exact same kind of pain when you lose somebody that you really can't stand to live without, or somebody that is so, so deeply in your heart, like most people aren't. And so I don't think Jesus is here to take it away, take away your suffering or your pain. It's just that for me, I might feel a sense of presence in it. I might feel a sense of his illumination in it. Also a sense of confidence that that energy isn't created or destroyed and that they're somewhere, and I just keep things very simple. I don't have interesting theological positions or understandings of heaven or surviving the soul or whatever, and it was just as devastating for anyone when someone dies as it is for another person. But with my mother, I don't think the two pieces are very Christian or meant to be. Most of a lot of the pieces in this are written by a Christian, but not about Christianity. They're just about real life and breathing, and they're very sort of Buddhist in a certain way, and they're also sort of furious and unforgiving in a way that's not specifically Christian. But the pieces with my mom were about having spent so much of my life being devoted to her and trying to take good care of her and having been just driven crazy by her my entire life and having lost a lot of my own identity and sense of self to who she needed me to be or was upset that I wasn't turning out to be. And so when my mom died, I just decided I wasn't going to turn the lie machine on anymore with her. So we had a beautiful service with all of her friends and our family. And then I put her ashes in the closet and said, I'm not going to scatter these ashes till I feel a genuine and authentic stirring in my heart to honor her. So it took quite a while. And one of the pieces is about the extraordinary effort it took me and the time it took to just get her ashes out of the closet and into the living room, where then they sat a while longer. And then about how on her birthday, she had a twin sister, I felt this very deep desire to have all of my relatives and our friends come up to the mountain where I live and to scatter and honor her ashes that day. So it's not particularly Christian. It's just really about how much the culture lies about almost everything, especially about death and aging, because it's terrible. It's kind of a real failure if you die young, but it's kind of disgusting if you live to be an old woman. It's even worse than being an old man because gravity has its say and whatnot. So you really can't win if you're playing by what the culture tells you. And I live in community, and I'm in the recovery community, and I have a lot of Buddhist friends, a lot of Jewish friends. And what I have come to understand is that God just loves real more than anything. And if I say to God, I don't feel like scattering my mom and having this pretense of holiness and forgiveness, I think God raises her fist, in the Black Power salute and says, well, good for you. Go with that. And so that then when I really could scatter her, there was some real grace involved, and there was some real spiritual growth that I could both experience and then share with other people who were feeling the same way.
When you're sitting down and writing an essay, any essay,
mm-hmm.
is there any hesitation anymore on your part that, oh, this is a part of me I don't want to reveal? Or do you just spew it out and then look at it afterward and go, oh, my God, this is usable or this isn't?
I'm extremely careful with boundaries before I begin anything. And when I write about Sam, I make absolutely dead sure that it will be something he would love to come upon. That is like a video that maybe you wouldn't want your girlfriend to see the first time you bring her over, but that are the way that I capture our life together, which is not in video. I don't write about most aspects of my life with Sam. I don't write about most aspects of my life with me. It's like I've used this analogy before, but in the very center of me, the bullseye of me, is the stuff that's really between me and the different ages of me, the little girl and the old woman and all the ages I've been and will be. And outside that ring, there may be two or three people that I share that very intimate human stuff with. And then on the second bullseye out, there's a whole bunch of people that I would talk to about it because I know they would find it universal and they'd laugh and cry and we could share that together. And as you go farther out, more and more bullseye rings from the bullseye, then I start getting to the material that I'm very comfortable talking about or that I feel passionately about sharing. So that I was on another FM popular local show here, and the person said, "So I guess you really think you spill your guts on the paper, but what about," and then he named another woman who writes really honest, intimate stuff, much more so than I do. And I thought, what a sexist, pejorative way of talking about the fact that forever, and maybe in America, especially since the women's movement, one of the greatest joys and one of the greatest salvations of women has been that we tell the truth, that we talk about stuff, that we don't keep a stern face that is supposed to convey both power and how well we're doing, that we cry, that we're messier. We've always been the messy gender. We have a lot more fluids, and we have stayed alive by sharing the truth as we understand it, by telling our secrets with one another. So by the time I publish something and you see something, boy, I am so comfortable with it, you know. So a lot of people think, oh, I just feel like it's not fair that I know you so well and you don't know me. And I think, well, what I write about is the part of you that I do know, and the part I let you read about me is the part I know about you.
You're pretty careful. There's a certain point when you got to shut down that self-censor and just go for it, and then,
I mean, there's not.
There isn't really?
No, I don't see why. I mean, there are several friends I would talk to about anything, and sometimes it takes me years to be able to tell the truth to them or to my therapist. But with my work, I have editors and copy editors, and I also have a couple of friends that read my stuff really carefully. And my editor might say, "Are you sure you want to go there?" But it's usually political. It's usually about something so ugly that I have felt or thought about somebody in the government, let's say. But with myself, I mean, I have people in myself that are my different ages and the different aspects of me, and they're not all outspoken. They're very, very shy people inside of me. There's a very, very shy and big facet of me. You know, all I can say is boundaries, 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 boundaries. A lot of people aren't going to like me, you know, and when I do a large reading, if there's 1,000 people there, I say, "I'm assuming most of you are liberal or progressive, and if you have been dragged here by somebody who didn't prepare you for how staunch a Democrat I am, then I'm sorry, but it's not my fault or my problem, and definitely this is something that liberals are going to enjoy more than conservatives."
That's part of the honesty. I mean, I guess for me, I have trouble, you know, revealing even on paper or certainly in a place like this anything about me. I just like pull back, and I'm amazed at anyone, this is male, female, old, young, who can just get it out there and then is willing to let other people see it.
Yeah.
You know, strangers. I find that an astonishing thing.
But isn't
that
what most good literature is? People,
Absolutely, yeah.
Most important speaking. Almost everything is about people standing up and saying, "I know you're not supposed to say this." In our families, we were taught not to even see what we saw. And one of the first, not only not to keep all the secrets of the family, which killed a lot of people, and, you know, both through the diseases that thing causes, but the secrets of abuse and the secrets of being violated in any number of ways. But not only were we not allowed to tell the truth, but we weren't even allowed to see it. And if we said, "I'm seeing this, I'm really scared," because mom and dad, they say, "Oh, no, that's not what's going on. Don't worry about it. That's not what's going on." So I think it's like the most radical thing of all to say, "You know what I saw?" And that's what I used to encourage my students to do, is to, you know, to tell them, you own what happened to you. And if you want to write this as fiction and disguise what your father was doing to all the children all those years, what your father was doing with other women all those years, then you do it as fiction, but you own it. It's yours. And if they wanted you to write differently about them, they should have behaved better.
And by owning it, you're also saying, "This is who I am," and just revealing the truth about you. And hopefully it's universal. I would assume most of the time it is.
I don't think hopefully it's universal. I mean, my career is based on the fact that I read everything on earth, and I read a lot of poetry, and I can see that it's universal. I can see that the poets that I love, like, say, Sharon Olds and Mary Oliver, or, you know, there's a great book out right now by Judith Moore called Fat Girl. Well, I'm not a fat girl, obviously, and yet this book is so rich and ripe with truth, and truth that's totally recognizable to me, although I was an emaciated girl, and that was equally bad in its own way, although maybe not quite. But I can see that the stuff that resonates for me, the stuff that makes me feel excited and like, "Oh my God, I am so in," by the first or second page, is stuff where I can just see what very, very, very smart, hip, funny people have survived, are surviving, and that is my story too. It's just the difference is that everybody's details are the same. I think everybody's story is basically the same.
Well, Anne Lamott, lately, you know, you read everything. What have you read? Novels, nonfiction, that has just gotten right to your heart of late?
Well, Fat Girl, I would say more than anything, yeah. And by Judith Moore, who lives in the East Bay, blew my mind. It's a tough, short, dazzling book, and she's also such a sensuous writer. She's written so much about food that it's just, there's a luxuriousness to it, too. Let's see, you know what I'm finally reading? It's another book I think I lied to people about having read, but I'm finally reading The Kite Runner, which I actually love. It's like this old bookstore in Marin that used to be called Paper Ships, and it's truly like a paper ship. I think it's beautifully written. I always read Mary Oliver. I always try to get a hold of Mary Oliver. I love this woman, Liesl Mueller, whose poem is at the beginning of Plan B. I think she's great. I love William S. Merwin, just unbelievably. I've been traveling a lot, so I've been trying to find really good literature that's also detective stories. And one was called Suspect by, I don't know how to say his name, but it's spelled Robottom or something, Michael Robottom, about a detective with early stage Parkinson's. I love the novel Case Histories by Kate Atkisson. I mean, they're truly literature, but you could read them for 5 or 6 hours on a plane.
Anne Lamott, when you are writing about grace, do you fully understand what it is?
Oh, I don't think anyone does.
Really?
Think you get hints of it, and it's like writing about God, and you know, it's my firm conviction that you can tell you've created God in your own image when he hates all the same people you do. And so I don't think we can know very much about God, and I know next to nothing except that I feel the presence of Jesus, and I feel it alone, and I feel it in community, and I feel it in the incredible goodness of most people. And with grace, you know, I in Traveling Mercies and in Plan B, I can say when I think I've experienced it. I can say what the glimmers of light look like that seem to be the gifts from the other side of the veil that are the truer aspects of our spiritual identity, or just as true as the dark and ambitious and clingy and unforgiving parts, you know, that are who we were born to be. And so what the best I can do is to say, well, I experienced this. I went from a very stuck place where I was all tied up in my own concerns and all wrapped up in myself, which is like the smallest package on earth, to feeling buoyant and expansive again, to feeling part of, instead of that cold, metallic sense of isolation that's so common for a lot of us. And or like with David Roach in the essay on his Church of 80% Sincerity, he, you know, with a serious, serious facial disfigurement, writes about moments of laughter and dancing with that material of darkness, of his darkness showing. And that's what grace looks like to me, is dancing with it instead of being squashed by it and making other people laugh and being given your own beauty back because something, some sort of energy or light or plates of the earth shifting took you from a place that you couldn't get out of on your own and didn't leave you where it found you.
Sometimes I get the feeling that if there's anything positive to be said about, you know, the past few years in American politics, it's that all of the little divisions that have split people on the left from one side of Democrat to the other, in my family even, you know, where I was a little bit to the left of the others, seem to have all disappeared in this kind of common idea that it may be really bad and may really suck, but at least we're all in it together.
Uh-huh. I'm not really aware of the divisions that are present in the left, only because I was so crushed by the election that I refused to read political commentary on why Kerry lost. And, you know, Kerry was a very devout Catholic, but he went to Mass every Sunday, but he didn't wear it on his sleeve. And I thought that was a really heroic and ethical thing to do. However, it wasn't a winning thing to do. I thought he did a great job. 48 million Americans voted for him, the second most people that have voted for anyone ever in the history of the Republic. And I haven't read much about the divisions. You know, in my own church, there's a lot of divisions. I'm a Presbyterian just by virtue of the fact that this is the church that I walked into at the end of my rope. And, You know, and there's factions in any church in this country. Not factions, but there's divisions. My pastor and I don't agree on everything. I've gotten mad at her before. I've said really, you know, I've crossed my arms and stamped my feet before in telling her how wrong I think she is. And you're allowed to be wrong in a democracy. And you're allowed to have your own the freedom of expression and opinion in democracy. So I just have to say I'm not particularly aware of the divisions in the left so much. I just think of that big number, 48 million, that voted for Kerry.
It makes you feel a little bit better.
A lot of things make me feel a little bit better, yeah.
Anne Lamott, I asked you before if you're working on any fiction. How do you feel about writing fiction compared to writing these essays?
Well, essays are a lot easier, obviously, because there's, you know, 7 or 8 pages usually, and there's a deadline, and there's just one short story I have to tell in them. And a novel takes a great deal more energy and focus and time. A novel takes me 3 years, and a book of essays I can have ready in a year and a half, and then maybe need another few months to really hone. But I have to have a certain kind of stamina before I can start a novel. And in fact, it took me a long time after Traveling Mercies to begin Blue Shoe, because I knew it's you have to do this kind of nautilus of your soul and of your creativity to get into shape to work with these same people for 3 years and to keep all these plates spinning in the air.
One final question, Anne Lamott. If you could look ahead and we can see a better America, what would it look like to you?
Well, it would look like the Democrats were in charge of the White House and were making the appointments to the judiciary, and that we had either the House of Representatives or the Senate. And it would look like finding a way out home to get everybody home from Vietnam. It would look like taking a lot of that money and using it to feed the poor.
You said Vietnam. You meant Iraq.
I meant Iraq, which I think is going about as well as Vietnam did. A number of people were killed in the last couple of days, but of course it's on page 18 or something of the New York Times. I think we've pretty much destroyed the country to set up this police state so that we can try desperately to get the oil we need. But, you know, it would look like I'm just like a not very interesting old knee-jerk liberal. And the country would look like a country that was based on social justice and civil rights and equality and a passionate commitment to the poor, to education, you know, to women's rights. And that would be about helping carry those opportunities out into our neighbors South and Central America and the other nations, instead of the, you know, the hammer of God of the American military might. So that's what it would look like to me, yeah.
You've been listening to an interview with Anne Lamott, whose latest book is Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.